Welcome to Turning Point, a podcast dedicated to sharing the always inspiring, sometimes heartbreaking stories of people working in the social services profession. We'll be hearing stories of triumph over incredible odds, as well as the setbacks and challenges that people face along the way. We'll hear from people working in addiction and mental health, residential treatment programs, and community-based services, as well as some of the clients that those people serve. We'll be focusing on how to increase your impact as a professional and the role of helping people overcome their own challenges through stories of impactful moments, both in treatment and in life. We'll hear tips, tools, strategies, and resources that you can apply to your own practice starting today. Turning Point is brought to you by Enviros, a diverse social services organization dedicated to strengthening youth and families in Alberta through a unique and powerful combination of experiential, strengths-focused, family-centered programming. You can learn more at www.enviros.org. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Coulard. This episode, we catch up with Dr. Lee Gillis, a psychologist, author, and academic who specializes in experiential, wilderness, and adventure-based therapies. Dr. Gillis has been absolutely instrumental in forwarding the field of experiential therapy in North America and beyond. He's the co-author of Adventure Therapy, Theory, Research, and Practice, one of the most comprehensive texts that's been published in the field to date. Enviros is lucky enough to have connected with Lee a few years ago, and he's been heavily involved in the evaluation projects at both our Shunda Creek and in Basecamp programs. Lee has a wealth of experience and some great advice for professionals and the field in general. Enjoy. Here's Lee.
Probably first and foremost, I'm a psychologist who's also a teacher and a researcher and try to be a practitioner. I've really tried to capture that triangle of studying things, doing things, and teaching things. So my career sort of is grounded in summer camps, and one of a seminal experience for me, looking back on the path, it seems like a path that looking forward at the time just looked like a fog, was when I took a course in abnormal psychology as an undergraduate. And I had the good fortune of just coming off of a wilderness instructor's course, going as my junior year of university, going to live at a state hospital, take abnormal psych, take advanced abnormal psych, live at the hospital. It just so happened that a psychologist was taking young men rock climbing. And he was thrilled that I was there and had some experience because he had basically been training field staff to do the belaying, et cetera. So I was able to see these young men in all these venues at the hospital, in school, rec, in their dorm. And when they went climbing, as I have told my students and have told the story multiple times, I had these very, just to kind of beat this metaphor to death, kind of grounded conversations when these guys went on belay and I was at the first pitch up, about 75 feet there in the mountains of North Carolina. And as I've looked at it, it's like something happened when those guys went on belay that was different from all these other milieus they were in. And I've been chasing that something for a long, long time. And so that drove me to on to work with young people in boarding schools to build ropes courses, to not do traditional types of training, or I should say challenge courses. They weren't known as ropes courses at the time. Yeah. And to pursue the kind of understanding what's going on when young people are in an outdoor, a challenging, sometimes a wilderness environment that is different and makes a therapy different. So I saw that happen when I was working with some affluent kids around Nashville at a boarding school, and how just going out and rappelling and climbing and just sitting around the fire at night and talking about what was going on in their families was so powerful for them. I pursued that into graduate school and then on down to Georgia College, where we built a challenge course here for the students. But more importantly for my career, I got involved with Project Adventure, which was about an hour's drive from here to work with, beginning with juvenile delinquents, kind of similar to what Enviros was working with. This would be 88, 89, and progressed into, as the state expanded who they needed help with, juvenile sex offenders, then juvenile substance use kids, into foster care, and seeing how the use of adventure, even within a residential treatment facility, seemed more profound and seemed to get at these kids, because we could talk about what just happened in the here and now, in the activity, versus what happened last Wednesday when they were either on the ward, in the home, you know, those types of things. It was happening in the moment. So that's really what has driven all my writing, all my career. Project Venture closed the doors over near here in terms of doing residential treatment. And for me, being involved in the Association of Experiential Education and doing presentations there was how I originally met Doug Darwish and was invited to come up to Enviros to do some training. Well, first, I guess, invited to ADAC to do a week's worth of training, and that led to a number of experiences of offering training with Enviros, and subsequently an AEE conference when Chris Mahoney offered us to apply for this grant that turned into Shunda Creek, and this whole quest to try to understand what Chris said to us was her driving question, which is, what's the added value of adventure and challenge and outdoor to treatment? And so I think for me, the good fortune was being able to partner with someone, Keith Russell, who I have tremendous respect for as a researcher. He's not a practitioner. He's very clear about that. And I said, I think this is a chance to try to put into practice some of these things that you have been writing about, that I've been pursuing. Here's a chance to really partner and work together. And that's just, you know, the last 3 to 4 years, that's really been the driving piece that's led us to see your work and the excellent things going on at Base Camp, and how that is similar to and different from what goes on at Shunda Creek. It was a long-winded answer, but that's kind of the kind of from the past to the present.
No, that's great. And my next question was going to dive into a bit more of the evaluation work that's been ongoing at Shunda Creek and started a year or two ago at Base Camp. And what exactly are you guys looking at? What are you looking for? Can you describe a little bit about the projects?
Certainly. My overall drive, my scientist psychologist hat is I want meaningful, relevant data. And so that's key for what's driving me. I fell down a rabbit hole for my master's thesis and my dissertation by measuring what was being measured in other dissertations. And it really flowed out of Outward Bound, out of Project Adventure, of let's look at self-esteem, let's look at locus of control. And again, the retrospect is a big whoop. So what? It had no impact on things that matter, the behaviors that matter, the things that matter to funders. And I saw programs close their doors. And I've said publicly that I feel personally responsible for not being able to see outside the box that was given to us to measure things that were relevant. So all that's to say, in coming to first to Shunda Creek, it was literally sitting with Keith and Bev and Serena and Jeff and Will, and just listening to the program, to their vision, what they had put together, and then bringing our expertise of, okay, here are valid, reliable, respected instruments in the literature that we think can get to that. And if we can use the instruments as intended to give you feedback clinically and programmatically, in a routine manner, much of what you guys are doing right now, that is going to let you adjust. It's that, Russell would say, I use this metaphor way too much, but that sense of getting vital signs from a program versus doing postmortems. And so I feel like so much of my career not really understanding the process of what doing a postmortem was all about on a program with by just doing pre and post testing, which is still going on too widely in the industry. So that's driving it. What is going to give you information as a program manager? What's going to give the clinical folks information that is useful on a week to week or a bi-monthly basis and helps you do adjustments? Because if that information is valid and reliable and is meaningful, especially if it's meaningful, you're going to do it. You're going to want to do it. So Russell's experience had been having to pry out from admins and all these wilderness therapy programs to do his dissertation to get them to get him the data. Fortunately, he picked the YOQ. He saw that that was the instrument to use at the time. And that was to his credit because that became widely used and that's widely respected. The difficulty was, I think, the sale to the clinical staff such that they found it such that they would use it as it was intended. And so he was having to beg, send flowers to admins and birthday cards, do anything possible, including going there himself to try to get the data. And I feel like we've kind of jumped over that fence and where people are seeing, especially what you're doing there, where they're really seeing the value of the data. And how it's not taking their jobs. It is really making them better at what they do.
Yeah, I think that's certainly been the experience for our frontline staff and our clinicians is that, you know, it's providing useful data, a bit of a handrail and a way to visualize change with clients, which oftentimes is really ephemeral. You know, did this person actually do anything over the past 3 months? And we can actually point to some of these instruments and say, well, according to them, yes or no or a little bit.
And it doesn't take the place of someone's clinical intuition and just your gut reactions to what's happening. It's that piece about when it's in sync, it's really cool. When it's out of sync and the data is telling you something different, it is a handrail. It provides a way to ask questions to see what's going on. But to think, I think that idea that of some clinicians to think that their gut is almost, you know, so I was listening to a story this morning on the radio about eyewitness testimony and all that we know about how poor that is in legal proceedings. And it seems like there's a parallel to think that I, as a therapist, because of all my clinical training, I really know what's going on with this client, this group, this program. And you may, but when you can also have this other data to validate that or to question that, that's the power.
Excellent. One of the things you guys have been working on since you got to Shunda is this tool called the Adventure Therapy Experience Scale. And it's really designed to unlock a bit of that black box or a bit of that mystery of what adventure therapy, what wilderness therapy, what experiential therapy does. And can you give me a bit of background on the development of that tool and any interesting data that's popped out or anything part of the process of developing that tool that stands out for you as interesting?
Certainly. It's really grounded in a Keith's article, now 10 years old, where he speculated theoretically on what happens in during the wilderness therapy experience, where the wilderness, as we've talked about it, being a co-therapist because kids are scared, et cetera, that getting used to being outdoors is so powerful. Then the social self begins to grow as you become more comfortable with setting up your tarp and eating your meals and your body adjusts to the physical realities of being in a program like that. And then the self. So you got your social self and then your personal self and how that begins to grow. And I think the sense of self-efficacy is you realize that you can do certain things and your confidence builds. And so he had kind of a flow chart over time about how those aspects would interact. And he had really wanted some way to test that out. And again, that was, I've always, when I've taught courses in adventure therapy with undergraduates or back when we had a graduate program, that was just a key article. I just thought he really tapped into something powerful. So when offered the Shunda Creek piece, it's like, hey, I think here is a testing ground. So we started with, and I guess he and I had multiple conversations about this, and the piece that I felt was kind of missing from what he was looking at, wilderness, group, leader, the self, but was this idea of reflection and the idea of the actual activity that you were involved in. So we set up the original 1.0 of the Adventure Therapy Experience Scale, you know, or 8, was ranking, forced ranking of what was the most powerful piece that happened in this experience, Shunda Creek young adult male, that you have just done. Rank order them, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And what I know from my experience of doing a lot of that type of work back in Project Adventure is that if you put them on a rating scale of 1 to 10, 1 to 7, then everything was going to be a 15 or an 11 because everything was powerful. You got no variability. It really wasn't going to help you out. So the ranking, they didn't like it, but it helped us get a sense of what was going on at various times. Well, statistically, ranked data is abysmal to try to deal with. And as we begin to try to put together reports and look at that and how it relates to the other variables going on, all along our driving question was Chris's question, what's the added value of adventure? So what our goal was to try to link the changes that are going on in the OQ45, which they're taking, the outcome questionnaire, with perceptions from these young men about the actual activity and what was happening there, to be able to show that as the OQ goes up or down and the experience was seen this way, we could link those things and begin to understand in the beginning of a time in treatment, this is important for the adventure. Middle, that's important. At the end, these other things are important. We sort of could take the number one rated aspect and graph that over time, and it was just this, it looked like somebody had, you know, dropped a ball, several spools of yarn. It just flowed over time, but it just, like, what sense does that make? And I remember driving home one day, just having struggled with this, and it's like, Keith, and we had all these comments. That was the other beauty of it. We had comments from the young men, and originally, we had comments from two different staff people about the experience that was going on. So we took the comments both from the guys and from the staff and began to craft questions around that were Likert 1 to 7 type or 1 to 10 questions that dealt with these various aspects of what was going on. So 2.0 was 21 questions that could be rated instead of ranked. The other piece that's coming in is that as mindfulness began to grow in the literature being really powerful, early on we just added a visual analog scale, which is just, as you know, just, you know, a 10-centimeter line, and ask these young men to talk about how mindful they were, just make a mark along that line from not at all to very much, how mindful they were of treatment. That mindfulness aspect also got incorporated into the questions that we were asking. So where we are right now is that in 2.0, we had about 500 responses, including base camp and several wilderness programs. And we factor analyze that, and it's sort of come down to about 5 factors. And now we're into 2.0. We got some feedback on shortening some questions, trying to make them clear. So we're trying to collect data on 2.1. And between now and June of this year, 2016, and with that data, putting together a manuscript that can put this instrument out into the public domain so that others may find it useful and that we can gather quite a bit more data. Not to make it proprietary, it really has its, it germinated at Shunda Creek. That'll always be part of the story. And it's grown through Enviros and been able to spread out to other programs. So that's kind of where we are right now.
Awesome. Very cool. Yeah, no, it's one of those tools that, you know, for a long time, treatment in general has relied on anecdotes to see if it's been successful or not, and has really been about the perception of staff and programs about what it is and how it works, and to have it an actual instrument that's giving reliable and systematic feedback from clients about the experiences they're having, whether it's on a high ropes course or a day trip or a, you know, 5-day canoe trip, being able to look at it and say, oh, this popped out for the clients and this was really powerful for them, allows us to then start to tailor experiences in treatments, you know, to the clients. So it's this kind of bigger version of progress monitoring with these program evaluation tools. So it's it's very cool. We've been getting a lot of use out of it. So.
And we've been very resistant, reluctant to resistance. Even from the first time we talked about it, the number of people, both in Canada and the U.S. and around the world who are, I'm doing my dissertation, can I use your instrument? And just to say, no, it is not ready for prime time at all. And we sort of wanted to make sure we do all the groundwork to have a pretty solid instrument that can go out there.
Yeah, no, for sure. Cool. We talked a little bit about experiential learning. I know that you've been active with the AEE, the Association for Experiential Education, for a long time. It's one of those things, experiential learning, that I think everybody thinks they know what it means and probably thinks that they do it well. But what are some of the misconceptions or myths or things that you see people doing that they're calling experiential therapy but isn't? And conversely, what would be kind of a good example of experiential learning done well, or some of the key components that you see the good practitioners or programs really embracing with that methodology of treatment?
Well, I think on one extreme, there's this notion that any experience, whatever experience, will speak for itself, and you put it out there and people will get what they need from it and move on. You just move on. So it's kind of captured in the wilderness literature as the mountains speak for themselves, that you don't need to add anything to that, that the experiences are powerful enough, and just leave it alone. And I've talked to people who take that to the extreme of even reflecting or debriefing or processing what has happened within a group situation can color that experience. If I say, well, here's what it meant to me, the person sitting beside me may think, oh my goodness, I didn't get that. So my experience now is devalued because of that. I feel like that's really an extremist point of view, especially when people say, so for that reason, we don't debrief at all. We never debrief. To me, so much of the power and what is lost is this reflection on experience. So it's that piece around making the experiential learning cycle complete by reflecting and letting the reflection feed into your understanding of even the next experience. So Mike Gass and I took the experiential learning cycle and expanded into a model we called changes, where you really looked initially at the context, who's there, what are you doing, what are your goals, et cetera, make some hypotheses about that, about how these folks are going to react, have some action, especially action that's novel, and I think that's a key piece to me of doing it well, where you catch people without any preconceived notions about what they're supposed to do. So you're not giving, as my mentor Carl Ronke would say, you don't pull out a soccer ball or a football or a basketball or a bat, something that people are like, oh, I know what we're going to do. And either I'm excited about that because I do that really well, or I'm not excited because I do not do that at all. And you have a novel experience, And from that, that generates just a lot of information that you can observe and you can evaluate. And I think that other piece is like, so how does that information into that system feed your next experience? What are you getting? What are the clients getting? I think that's when it's done well, Jeff, is that you're really, it's that cycle is not just a circle, but it spirals, whether that's up and to greater things or deep into kind of what's going on. So leaving out the reflection, which I think a lot of people do inadvertently, or they either assume that it's being done or they don't believe in it. They feel like it's going to ruin the experience. I think that's, in my opinion, where it's done poorly.
If you had to pick one thing to change about the current state of addiction and mental health treatment in North America, what would that be and why? What drives you nuts about what we're currently doing with in that field?
Oh my goodness!
It can be multiple things if one doesn't.
Yeah, the hot topic that I've understood from my early experiences, even in graduate school, with being when I lived at a home that was for people coming out of 28-day treatment. And I was no more than a caretaker of the building. And because of that experience, I got to attend a lot of open 12-step meetings. And I got to sit in with some of the men who had rented this house and were letting me live there for free as they had a group process with the young men living in the house every week. I got to sit there and listen to these. These were not therapists. These were recovering physicians and contractors. And one was my mentor who was a psychologist. And this power of 12 steps. I mean, I've got to see that. I also have seen the way it, for some people, is doctrine to the point that everything is bipolar, in that you're either completely sober or you're addicted and you're using again. And any use is unhealthy use. My mentor, Warren Bonney, God rest his soul, who was also an addict, said to me something this obvious but really profound. If addiction was one thing, we could have probably one or two treatments that would be successful with it. But it's so multifaceted, you know, involving genetics and involving our family history that can be different from our DNA and our environments, that we just really need to try to understand what that's like for, you know, other – For a lot of clients. So that's a long way of saying that I think where 12-step gets pushed is the only way. I think it sets programs up for failure, because it would say in some ways that if you have relapse, then you have failed. I think the whole harm reduction work is powerful, also very controversial regarding, you know, how do people find their space within some healthy use of substances. So we, in the alumni questionnaire we did for Shunda Creek, we were intentional to ask about relapse, but we also asked them how they were dealing with substances now. And looking at that idea, I'm doing okay with it versus I'm not doing at all well with it, to get people thinking about it. So that, I don't know that we could change it. I think one reason, there's not a lot of strong evidence about 12-step programs. There's just not a lot of data out, because it's anonymous. I mean, it's in its name. I do think where it works has to do with where people get a good sponsor, and it's the relationship. And it really comes down to a relationship with that person.
Yeah, no, I think when you look at, you know, some of the research of, I think of Scott Miller and some of the therapeutic factors that he's pointing out, or, you know, the therapeutic alliance and relationship is one of the you know, regardless of the methodology of treatment, it's that piece that really pops out of his literature anyway. But that I think AA probably does well, but I think I agree certainly on the harm reduction versus total sobriety and that spectrum. You know, there's still a lot of pressure, I think, for addicts to be totally clean. And that kind of flies in the face of experiential learning, where you have experiences and you learn from them, and you use those as, you know, sometimes the relapses and the home visits that go poorly for our clients are the biggest turning points in their treatment. So it's interesting.
Yeah. And I think for some clients who, under that model of I'm either sober or I'm not, once I'm not, then I've heard people say this, I might as well give up. Why not use? Because I'm destined to do that anyway, so I'm just going to continue to do that.
I believe that's called the abstinence violation effect. That once you violate your abstinence, you're off to the races.
Yes.
Excellent. Do you have any favorite books that you recommend people check out, or anything that's been influential for you in your growth that you'd like to pass along to listeners? Besides your own, obviously, which I'll include links to all of your stuff in the show notes.
You know, I think pieces like for the work that we do, Gary Ferguson's work on Shouting at the Sky, where he spent a lot of time with kids in wilderness and told a lot of their stories, a really powerful book, especially powerful for people who think they want to do this kind of work. He's not a therapist. He's a nature writer. And he, I think, has done a great job of capturing the good and the bad of what goes on. His recent book, The Carry Home, is a very, for me, kind of a difficult book to read. It has to do with the fact that he and his wife were up in Canada on a canoe trip, and that turned awful because of flooding, and that they were not, aware of. The boat flips. He survives. It takes a while to find her. She dies. The whole book is about the carry home is taking her ashes to all these various places that were very powerful in their relationship and their marriage, and him telling stories about the power of nature and the power of relationship. And he's able to weave in his fascination with wilderness therapy, his fascination with wolves. But what comes through so clearly is this power of this relationship between two partners, two people. And in terms of kind of nonfiction books, that has just been really, really powerful and useful to me. I mean, those are the things that kind of come to mind. The other thing I'm using in my class right now is Meg Jay's a psychologist out of Virginia, and she's written a book about 20-somethings called The Defining Decade. And I started using that last semester. It's several years old. It's in the popular press. She's a psychologist. It's well-grounded in evidence. But even yesterday, my undergraduates had read the first chapter, and much like happened last semester, the first chapter is all about identity capital and ways in which young 20-somethings can do things that are going to further their sense of what they want to do with their lives, to try things out and to move in that direction. And it was just amazing to me that several of those undergraduates here, it was the first chapter, had already made some decisions about current jobs they were in. And one of them had a job at a downtown restaurant where she could make really good tips. And the other was at an arboretum. And she just said that right before class, she went and quit the job at the restaurant because while it was good money to have, her passion was in the arboretum and teaching kids. And it's like, that's where I want to spend my time. So, the beauty of that book to me has been I'm not telling people like, here's how you should run your life. Listening to these, 20-somethings sit around the room and talk about decisions that they're making and how these are very, very important times for them. And I think that to me, that feeds in both to these Shunda Creek young men and, some of the tough roads that they have had and the tough home lives that they have now came from clients that you have, the boys and girls, the young men and women that you see at base camp. These are really crucial times for making decisions. And, you know, Meg Jay says a really good thing, and she has a great TED talk on this whole piece where, her point is when you tell a 20 something that you got, 10 more years to really get on with your life, like, what do you expect is going to happen? And she says, you know, nothing's going to happen. they're going to really do nothing. So that's been, I've enjoyed seeing the power of how these young people seeing this information and captured within her clinical wisdom, using some of her case stories to tell those stories, impacts these kids. And I get to have the privilege of just listening to them.
Awesome. Cool. Those sound like both great recommendations. And I will be certain to check those out myself. So besides reading those books, what advice would you give a young professional? So a youth worker just starting in a program, whether they're doing wilderness and adventure therapy or not, but they're in the helping profession, working with clients in need. What advice would you give them to further their growth and profession? And yeah, just in general, what do you think people should do more of?
Well, I encourage residential treatment, whether it's wilderness or not, for a lot of my students coming out of psychology, even at the undergraduate level, because for those who think that that's what they want to do, I think as you know as well, when you get in the trenches in working day to day in a 24/7 or 5 days a week, 24 hours a day, it really lets you know if this is what you want to do. And as I was asking my, I mean, I think the other piece I was asking my students yesterday, how many of them had gone to camp in the summer or other times, how many had worked at camp? And that idea for me of working at camp and then working in residential treatment is where you get to be around people who, no matter what their age, who can find your buttons and can push them and push them and push them. And how you deal with that and how you learn to react to that is, I think, really, really powerful. So that sense of putting yourself in the milieu is, I think, is wonderful. So I encourage folks to get out. I had a student who really wanted to be a data person, but he went to a wilderness program hoping that he could work in the field to become kind of their data person. And he just realized that was not what he wanted to do. And we talked about that was great information for him. It's like, I can't do this. I don't have what it takes to do this. I respect people who do it, but it's not going to be me. So I think his willingness to take a risk and to try it out is really powerful. So, you know, the simple thing is kind of getting into systems and just doing it. The roll the dice is being in good systems where you have good, strong cultures that do not chew people up and spit them out, have really awful supervision or no supervision. I think that can do a tremendous amount of detriment. I mean, I've had, as all of us, I've had good supervisors clinically, and I've had some bad ones. We learn from all of them. If you have too many of those bad ones, it can, I think, really have you call into question some of your own instincts. If it wasn't for the cohort of folks that I was with, sort of in graduate school, that we could kind of support one another, I think it could have had some tremendous impact, the negative impact on me as well.
Cool. No, I think that's great advice. Interestingly enough, I started in the summer camp world myself, and I know lots of people that in the field that do. It seems to be a breeding ground for, you know, further helping professionals.
I agree.
Cool. What are you up to next? What's on the horizon for Lise? You're doing some teaching. You're doing some evaluating. Do you have anything else in the works that's interesting or that's getting you really excited these days? Besides, obviously, your ongoing work with Shunda and Basecamp.
For me, it's kind of building. Well, I guess it's recognizing that we're not going to have randomized controlled trials of wilderness therapy in a way that for some people would allow us to kind of reach that gold standard. And I gave up on that many years ago because I think there's just way too many obstacles, and why not do what we can do, which is, I mean, this work that Keith and I did with Dennis Kivligan, who's a big group researcher, and having those relationships that I have been able to develop, Keith's been able to develop with other researchers who can look at a data set and see, wow, you know, we could look at this, and you're going, really? Wow. Okay. Someone who because of their experience, can see things that I don't know exist. So I think finding ways to look at relationships with the data, and as we gather more data with Basecamp and Shunda Creek, I think it's being able to pull alumni data and look backwards and see what factors were going on during the treatment that seems to lead toward health. And let's do more of that. Let's be real solution focused. And so that's really kind of driving me now from a research standpoint of our ways to contribute to the field that are meaningful and can help move things forward and get us into reputable journals in psychology and social work and substance use journals that people begin to really take notice, because we have peer reviewed articles that are out there and we're just not navel gazing.
Exciting. Very exciting. Cool. Is there any last parting thoughts or things you want to share with the audience? You've got a minute or two. I know you're a busy guy, and I'm going to actually be talking to you again here in a couple of hours on the project. But anything that we've talked about that you want to dive into or revisit, or anything that we didn't cover that you think is important?
Well, there's probably a timing thing. I feel really honored that we can work in Canada, in a province, certainly a province is going through a lot of financial issues with the current price of oil and the Canadian dollar, but a province that has invested in youth care and is willing to invest. I think it has a lot to do with the folks at Enviros invest in trying to evaluate that in meaningful ways. That ship, for the most part, sailed in the States back in the 90s. And I kind of back to where I was starting, I think we were gathering the wrong data. We were not looking at things that matter to funders, like recidivism in treatment, like relapse, and trying to understand what were we doing in wilderness and experiential therapies that was better than, different than just traditional talk therapy. So that to me is exciting, where you have some government funding and we're not just working with kids who can afford. The programs in the States are private pay and they're extremely expensive. And it's, you've seen the data many times. It's that typical, we got a Caucasian male, 16 years old, who comes from a affluent, but really, of course, for the most part, a pretty screwed up family. And that's who we're working with. And there's just a lot of folks that we're not able to touch, where you guys are able, but I think because of what's going on in the funding that you have certainly in Alberta with Alberta Health Services through Enviros, I think we're able to both understand things, but also impact a wide variety of the population. It's beautiful.
Hey guys, thanks a lot for checking out this episode with Dr. Lee Gillis. This episode was brought to you by Proving Grounds. Proving Grounds is a multi-sport adventure race that Enviros puts on every year. The premise is pretty simple. You take the fun and laid-back atmosphere of your favorite mountain bike relay event, add in some trail running as well as a challenge course, compact the distances to create a single loop ranging between 1 and 1.5 hours. The end result is an 8-hour race offering the best of everything in off-road multi-sport racing for you and your family. I highly encourage you to check it out at www.provinggrounds.ca.